This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. These days, the great Canadian author Margaret Atwood is best known for her books, The Handmaid's Tale and its 2019 sequel, The Testaments, both of which have become acclaimed television series and miniseries, respectively. Among Margaret Atwood's other novels are Cat's Eye, Surfacing, which became a film, The Robber Bride, which also became a film, and Alias Grace, which became a TV miniseries. But along with several other novels, story, and essay collections, there's a satirical dystopian speculative fiction series known collectively as the Mad Atom Trilogy, consisting of Oryx and Crake, The Year of the Flood, and Mad Atom. I interviewed Margaret Atwood for each book in the series, and this interview, the most recent interview to date, concerned that third novel, Mad Atom, and was recorded in the KPFA studios on October 3rd, 2013. My guest is Margaret Atwood, whose latest novel is Mad Atom. It's the third volume in a trilogy that includes Oryx and Crake and Year of the Flood. We'll also be talking about a book that came out last year called In Other Worlds, SF and the Human Imagination. There are 22 books of fiction in all, including Handmaid's Tale, Cat's Eye, 15 books of poetry, 11 books of nonfiction by Margaret Atwood. When you wrote Oryx and Crake, did you intend for it to be a trilogy?
No. I would like to say yes, because I would like to sound more organized than I am. But in fact, when I was writing it, it was just going to be one book. Shortly after I finished it, however, I realized that people were going to wonder what he did next. And so was I going to wonder that. And I also wanted to explore two groups in that book that he can only see at the train window or on television because he lives in a gated compound community. He doesn't go out into the wide, wide world. But these other groups are out there, and one of them is the God's Gardeners, the Green Religious Cult in Year of the Flood, and the other one are the Mad Atomites, who are not pacifist, but actively resisting the corporately controlled world in which they all live.
So when you were writing Year of the Flood, you knew that there would be that third book by then?
As soon as I knew that there were going to be two, I knew there were going to be three.
And at that point, you also realized that this would allow you to explore the role of women in that society, which is, of course, a takeoff on our society.
Oh, you mean because the narrator of Oryx and Crake is one male person all the way through. I did that partly because people constantly said to me, why are you always writing from a female point of view? It wasn't entirely true, but predominantly. And the answer, because I'm lazy, never really satisfied them. So I thought, okay, so I'm going to do the whole book from the point of view of Jimmy. And as soon as I'd published that book, they began saying, why did you write it from the point of view of a man? What's wrong with women? You can't win.
At the same time, this did allow you to explore that same world through different eyes.
Absolutely. And that's one of the pleasures of having other worlds, is that you can view them from various angles. I suppose it's also one of the pleasures of writing about our world. You can do the same thing, but with other worlds, there are always things that we don't know about those worlds that you can see better through different points of view.
Was it tough maintaining consistency? I mean, obviously you're creating a world when you're writing the first book, but then suddenly you're expanding on the world, and it's a world that you've created several years ago, so maintaining consistency and maintaining the satirical element as our world changes can get to be a challenge.
Yes, well, the notebook and the post-it note are my friend. If it were a movie, you would call it continuity. But it's not hideously hard. And if you have a very, very good copy editor, as I do, she will say things to you like, you give Jimmy 5 Jolt bars and he eats one here, one here, one here, one here, one here, and one here. So you either have to Give him one more or have him eat one fewer. Somebody's going to count. If you don't, somebody else will, and then you'll get the outrage letter that begins, "You idiot."
Well, Margaret Atwood, how conscious are you of the various themes in your book when you're writing it?
I don't think of them as themes. I think I just think of them as the realities of that world. And the other question that you asked was really about, okay, so you're writing about a world that is plausible within the context of ours. And if you then write about the same world several years later, things have changed in ours, and how much of a problem is that? Well, several of the things that I proposed as reality in Oryx and Crake were only theoretical in our world at the time, but now they've come true. Whereas several other things have happened that were not anticipated in Oryx and Crake. So Jimmy, for instance, is not a user of social media in Oryx and Crake. Would he have been? I'm not entirely sure that he would have been. They're doing interactions on their phones, and they're playing computer games and watching reality TV of various kinds. But they're not Twittering and Facebooking and doing things like that. Now, since they're boys in Oryx and Crake, I'm not entirely sure that they would do a lot of that. Adolescent boys, what do you think?
They might. But the other part of it is that in 2004, no one would have suspected that, in fact, texting or Twittering would replace even Facebook.
I don't think it's replaced it. I think they're now all joined in various macrame knot types of ways. They all seem to lead to each other.
When you're talking about things that have happened, I kept thinking, chicky knobs. Okay, you have chicky knobs, chickens without heads. And of course, we now have pink slime, and we have this new beef or something that I just read about.
The lab-grown hamburger. First of all, somebody is working on the headless chicken plan, by the way. And the human kidneys growing in pigs that we find in Oryx and Crake were underway at the time, but there were various blocks to that which have now been overcome. So a kidney for you may be coming to a pig in your neighborhood soon.
That, of course, brings up the idea that we learn new things about the pigoons.
We do, because they've also been growing human cortex tissue, originally intended for transplant, but then, of course, things get out. As for the lab-grown meat, I've heard a certain amount of yuck over that issue, and I also heard needed a bit more salt. But it wouldn't be necessarily such a bad idea, because it would certainly cut down on methane emissions. And no animal has suffered to make this lab-grown hamburger. I've got some lab-grown protein of other kinds, and also I've got some plants that grow protein in the books, and those are not out of the question.
One of the great things about being able to read a book like In Other Worlds alongside Mad Adam is I can see connections between your own history in science fiction and the books that you're writing. So in this particular case, when we're talking about these strange new life forms which help save the planet, it brings up the question of something that you present about Brave New World, which is, depending upon the way you look at it, it's either a utopia or a dystopia.
Exactly. And that is true of satirical utopias like Brave New World. It's also true that the two forms, the utopia and the dystopia, are joined at the hip in a kind of yin-yang fashion, so that every utopia, every literary utopia, has got a dystopia concealed within it, and every literary dystopia has got a utopia concealed within it. We measure good and bad by comparison. You can't see the bad qualities, for instance, of the people in Brave New World unless you set them beside something else, which the people in Brave New World view as a dystopia, but we might view as a fuller humanity.
That would almost be as if a Christian Baptist from the South would read Handmaid's Tale and go, yeah, right on.
Good idea. There has been a certain amount of web discussion centering around good idea, Handmaid's Tale.
Are you serious?
I'm entirely serious. There was also a lot of chat about it at the time of the most recent presidential election in which people were saying things like, somebody please tell the Republicans The Handmaid's Tale is not a blueprint. But it comes out most obviously when people kick back against The Handmaid's Tale, people who actually have the same things in mind and would think they would be pretty good, attack the book. It's sort of an odd thing. You'd think that if that's what they really think, they would say, yeah, that's us.
You mentioned before that in some ways we've deviated from the path of 2004. You're just talking on the surface, let's say in terms of social media, or is there some other deviation that you were looking at?
No, I'm afraid the rest of it is fairly on track. We have since that time had quite a few more revelations, for instance, about Big Pharma and how they conceal the results of the tests upon their very own drugs. So in the world of Mad Adam and Year of the Flood, etc., the pharmaceutical corps are making drugs that cause you to become ill, but then they're also making the drugs that are supposed to fix those illnesses that they themselves have caused. And the ultimate goal, the ultimate commercial goal, is to keep you just ill enough all the time until all of your money is soaked up.
There was a time, I think, probably when I was reading that first book and I was, you know, shaking my head and going, you know, it's a little bit over the top. But then we learn about Monsanto, and I keep wondering, is it paranoia when your fears are being realized?
No, that's not paranoia. It's only paranoia when your fears are not being realized. When your fears are being realized, I think it's called bad news.
I noticed that you had the split between these gated communities, if you want to call it, and the plebe lands. And again, 2004, I wasn't seeing that as much. But of course, now what we're seeing, particularly in the United States, is this gap between everybody and the 0.1%.
Yes. Think back far, far into the past at a time of, for instance, the Norman conquest of Wales or Ireland, in which you would have the castle with the walls and the aristocrats inside, and then you would have the peasants outside. And that's what we're essentially recreating. In fact, it's in Norwich and Craig right at the beginning. It's like castles, and they have therefore guards, and who gets in and who besieges it, you know, who tries to get in, who is kept out. It's very much the same idea. It's always been true about societies in which there have been gaps, and that would include every society that I know about. Once we get architecture, it starts to happen. Once we get agriculture, it starts to happen, because that's when surpluses are generated and you can afford things like kings and priestly cults and armies. But you have always had the wall, the enclosed garden, the water feature. The rich have always liked water features, and the art that you put inside. And then you have the proletariat outside. Did you ever play that game as a child, which is, which would you rather be? Somebody who's inside the castle being besieged, or somebody who's on the outside besieging it?
I didn't, but go ahead.
Well, it's a toss-up. It depends partly on how many supplies you've got inside the castle. That is how long you can hold out. And it also depends on things like how diseased the besieging armies get. So it's whether the people inside are going to starve to death, whether the people outside are going to give up, because they too have their supply lines. They too can run out of food. But we've gotten to a whole new level with that nowadays, because we have vastly superior tracking devices, vastly superior surveillance devices, and a much greater ability to cut people off.
Do you think that the split is the human condition? I was thinking as you were talking that even when they tried to make everyone equal, say in the Soviet Union, you wound up with the two groups, the nomenklatura, and then everyone else, even there. So I keep wondering, is this human nature?
No, I don't think it's human nature. I think if you read a guy called Ian Morris, he would see it as a feature of an agricultural society. And he would see an information society, as which he feels that we are now in, as leading ultimately to somewhat more equality. I'm not sure about that. It's led to more gender equality for a very simple reason, that in an agricultural society without cheap energy, you are depending on upper body strength and also on inheritance, which in our Western European society has largely been inheritance through the male line. So things like female chastity, you know, they become fetishized. You read Shakespeare nowadays and you think, why were they so fixated on that? Well, because it was an agricultural society still, essentially. He would say that therefore when cheap energy comes in and keyboarding becomes a dominant activity, that women can keyboard just as well as men, and that levels things out somewhat more.
But in terms of the rich versus poor,
when it gets to this point, you have to start worrying, because you're looking at the Ancien Régime in France right before the revolution, and how did they get into such a jam? Well, they spent too much money on a foreign war that would be helping America with the revolution. And then they felt that to compensate for that, they had to tax more. But people already felt severely taxed. And then the price of bread went up. And then they dithered. They could have kept that aristocracy in place if they had made more concessions earlier, but they didn't.
Well, I keep thinking that that's exactly what Roosevelt was about in the 1930s.
Oh, Conrad Black would agree with you. He wrote a whole book about that, saying, you know, Roosevelt was the biggest friend of capitalism America's ever produced, because he kept people just well fed enough. You know, he did just enough to prevent full scale revolution. But as for the Soviet Union, well, since we're talking about utopias and dystopias, one reason it became so hard to write literary utopias in the 20th century was that several real ones had been tried with unpleasant results. One of them was the USSR, which I think a lot of people believed in, but I don't think Stalin ever believed in it for an instant. I think he was just an opportunist who used it as a way to enshrine himself as chief thug. So there was that one, and there was the Nazis. None of these people came in saying, I'm going to make your life unbelievably miserable. They came in saying, I'm going to make it unbelievably better, except first we have to do something about those people. We have to get rid of quite a few in the case of Stalin, and also in the case of Hitler, and of Pol Pot, and of Mao.
When Putin tries it with gay people, it seems to be backfiring.
I think you can partly thank the internet for that. And also, gay people are they're not all located in one place. They're hither and thither. It's harder to, although Hitler did quite a bit of rounding them up and putting them in camps, it's a bit harder, I would think, in Russia to squash all of them.
Getting back to Mad Adam and In Other Worlds, as I was reading In Other Worlds, several elements that pop up in your trilogy came up, one of which is H.G. Wells' Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, I did write an introduction to it, which is in Other Worlds. But the new items that Dr. Moreau is working on, he's trying to peopleify animals, and he's doing it by vivisection, which is incredibly painful to the subjects. He is a very ruthless and cold personage. So he's not genetically engineering a benevolent, kindly, new race of people. He's experimenting on animals to try to turn them into people.
Yet at the same time, there is that connection in that they're both trying to enhance.
They're both trying to enhance something. Wells himself said, you know, I've written a blasphemous book. So I think he was having a poke at religions as well as everything else, because the animal people, who of course keep wanting to revert to their previous state, especially the predators, they're given a quasi-religion with a quasi-group of Ten Commandments, which they recite in a kind of mindless way. But they keep slipping off the straight and narrow and, you know, eating flesh, secretly eating some flesh.
At the same time, the Krakers of your books are creating their own religion too. And
well, they're having some help.
Yeah, the creatures had some help on Moreau's Island as well.
Yeah, but theirs has got no thou shalt nots in it. You will notice there are no thou shalt nots in their religion because they're not inclined to make up rules like that. They're not inclined to do anything that they naturally are not designed to do.
The difficulty there is the Krakers, these creatures that have been created, these human creatures, genetically changed creatures who don't have some of them humanity's worst traits, when they come up against the worst elements of humanity, they have no way to deal with it.
They would be helpless. Number one, they wouldn't understand it, and number two, they would have no comeback because they're not aggressive. But if you read the histories of early contact when Europeans, for instance, landed in Middle, South, and North America, it was quite frequently that story that the people with the non-steel-based technologies and quite different religious and cultural systems didn't understand at all these European people and why they were doing these terrible things. It wasn't just disease, which of course laid waste 95% of the population, but it was the behavior of the Europeans that was completely baffling to them.
In Other Worlds, Margaret Atwood, you also talk about creation of a superhero mythology. Now, you created your own as a kid with bunny rabbits, but later on, I'm looking at the Krakers and their mythology involving Krake and Orcs is also a superhero mythology.
Well, more like deities. So I think when you have a language that includes past tense and a pluperfect, people learning that language or people coming into that language are sooner or later, and in the case of children sooner, going to say, where did I come from? And then they're going to say, but before the cabbage, before I was, who made the cabbage? Well, who made the first cabbage? And what about before that? So there is this infinite recession until you get to a starting point. And if you look at mythologies of the world, there's always a starting point of some kind. So that's what they're doing. And Jimmy, the human being among them who has become their shepherd, doesn't know how to answer that question, but he tells them at first the truth, which is you were made by Krake. Well, okay, who's Krake? So he's not going to say, well, he was the psychopath. So he's, because he doesn't want to alarm them or make them upset or distress them. They're so kindly. So he says that Krake is a benevolent and kind and just wanted their best and is watching over them and various things like that. And because he was in love with Oryx, the girlfriend of Krake and also of Jimmy, he puts her in as a female deity. Very kind and benevolent as well. So they have a very nice religion. So everybody in it is good and kind, and there's none of this trampling and crushing and annihilating that goes on in some religions.
As you're writing this, it's a gentle satire. Did you ever have any problems going, how far can I go with the satire and still maintain emotional reality?
You think it's a satire? Going too far. Well, I try not to go too far outside the bounds of plausibility because I'm not writing about a galaxy far, far away with, and in another time with the dragons or Darth Vader, worse luck. Much though I like viewing and reading about such things, I'm not good at doing them. So I am writing about in our time pretty much on this planet and the problems that the world that's there before Krake wipes it out with the man-made virus, those problems are our problems, except they've become somewhat greater. So the glaciers have melted more, the sea level has risen more, people are living in New York rather than New York because it's further uphill. So it's on that order. It's the stuff we already have and are doing, but just a bit further along. And I'm not sure that's satire. I think it's more like, are you sure you really want to go there?
Margaret Atwood. In Other Worlds is mostly older essays. There are a couple of new ones in there. But I'd like to ask you about an essay which you might write, which would be about the current fixation in films and the success of superhero movies and how you think they play into the current cultural context.
We had the superheroes as comic book characters in the 40s and early 50s, and then a whole new generation came along with the Spider-Man and newer superheroes. But I think the impulse for kids is always the same, which is, I am a child, I am weak, and I have to do what everybody else tells me. So that is the superhero in his ordinary person disguise. He's usually some one-down person like Clark Kent that is laughed at by Lois Lane. And then there's me as I would like to be. So it's my vengeful id. Except I'm not going to make the vengeful id a bad thing. I will project the vengeful id as the superhero's enemies. But the superhero himself will be pretty much for the forces of good. So are we in the land of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? I think we're a bit more in the land of child self realizing its lack of power and having as a friend a great, big, more powerful being, which is also why kids like dinosaurs. They wouldn't like them if they were here in real life, because they would be food. But to have a pretend dinosaur that is your friend, or a great big animal of some kind, is like having a much more biddable adult being to do the dirty work for you, as it were.
Then we go back and say, okay, well, Avengers was the number one movie last year. Iron Man 3 is the number one movie this year. So if you're taking that analysis to, say, the population at large, then we're seeing kind of an upswing in the feeling of powerlessness, which may go exactly back to what we were saying before about the split society.
It's very much an old fairy tale motif, and it's very much the plot of the Odyssey. In the last part of it, where Penelope has been besieged by these really unpleasant people, and Odysseus comes in disguised as a beggar, and everybody spits upon him. And then he whips out his bow and kills everyone, to a great feeling of satisfaction. So it is quite a bit like that. And the vengeance thing, before Disney got hold of them and prettied them up and made everybody be friends at the end, stories like Cinderella did not end well for the bad sisters. They ended in eyes being pecked out, and in some instances, people being made to dance to death in red-hot shoes or being put into barrels full of nails and rolled downhill. This is what children like in stories, is number one, a lot of action. But number two, they want to know who the bad people are, and they want those bad people to be abolished at the end of the story so that they don't have to worry about them being under the bed. They want them done away with. I mean, these are fairy tales. Superhero movies are fairy tales that are satisfying on that level. You know who the bad people are. You know who the good people are. Splat, splat, splat. That's the end of the movie.
What is positron?
Positron. Fooling around on the internet, which I do hither and thither because I feel that a person of my age is in a position to stick their hand into the lion's cage and see what's in there. So I've tried out various things that are online manifestations. And one of them is Viliner, which has come to fill the niche that was once occupied by longer nonfiction pieces in magazines and newspapers and serial fiction. At the time of Dickens, they were numbers. They published books serially in numbers. Then they migrated into newspapers and magazines, thus giving us Sherlock Holmes, who would not exist otherwise. And that continued through the 20th century until about the 70s, 80s, when magazines publishing fiction started to fade. Well, it faded, except for The New Yorker, which soldiers bravely on. So, therefore, where can people publish short fiction anymore? They publish then literary quarterlies of various kinds, which somewhat influences what gets published. Well, every time there's a publishing platform, it will influence what gets published because people write for that platform. So therefore, Byliner is something that you can go on to and read longer nonfiction pieces, and you can read longer short fiction pieces. And I wrote one of those and then started building it out into a serial. So there's now four of them.
Is it science fiction?
It's not science fiction as of the other planet, galaxy far, far away, nor is it science fiction fantasy with dragons in. It is an extrapolation of where we are now.
Like the trilogy.
That, it appears, is what I can do, whereas I cannot do dragons. So remember when you used to draw as a child and you probably had a few things that you drew quite well, and then you other things that you just couldn't do. And you can usually tell an amateur painter because they will paint a nude person with their hands concealed by a velvet drapery because they can't do hands. So I can't do, you know, real science fiction of the other planet kind, but it appears that I can do extrapolations of where we are now.
Eventually, will this be published as a real book?
Yes, I'm going to rearrange it somewhat and build it out into a real book. It will be a novel.
And it will be probably your next novel.
It will be my next novel. You're very prescient.
Margaret Atwood, what is the future of books?
Oh, what a question. Let us say, what is the future of stories? Stories will continue to be told by human beings because that is one of the things we do as human people. And you can tell what those things are pretty much by what kids do before the age of four and just soak up spontaneously from their environment. You don't have to sit them down and hammer it into their head. This is a story. They get it. And they get it from about the age of one. This happens, this happens, this happens. They understand that. So we will continue to tell stories while we are still walking the planet. How we will transmit those stories, that is another question. But let me say to you the following. There are several things that we should be aware of in relation to digital information. And one of them is magnetic pulses, which could just wipe everything. So that would include certain kinds of solar flare. The digital decay black hole that everybody is increasingly aware of. This information decays over time. So if you don't have a hard copy, your stuff may be lost. Remember the floppy disk? Yes. Try finding somebody who can read that for you now. So there's that. There's internet overload and there's electrical brownouts. So all of these things are going to affect the ability to store narratives digitally. Make copies is my advice to you. The other advice to you about books is you don't kill them if you drop them in the tub, and they make great insulation and kindling in a pinch.
I would also say the government or whomever can't suddenly decide to erase them.
The government cannot decide to erase them, and the government can also not track what you're reading. So if you have a book, you can be perusing it under the bed sheets, which is where I read quite a few books, with my little flashlight. This will ruin your eyes, said they. And nobody, unless they catch you with that flashlight on, nobody's going to know you're doing it. Whereas, as it turns out, there's a huge amount of data mining going on and tracking and snooping and counting that goes on online. So if you don't want to be tracked and snooped in that particular way, you will take a cue from the God's gardeners who say quite rightly, if you can see it, it can see you. And they don't use cell phones or computers. They use slates and chalk.
Margaret Atwood's next novel was indeed the science fiction novel, The Heart Goes Last, set in the future in which the lawful are locked up
and the lawless run free. The novel is set in the same near-future dystopia as the darkly comic byliner serial Positron, which was released online and is discussed in this interview. You've been listening to an interview with Margaret Atwood, recorded October 3rd, 2013, in the KPFA studios while she was on tour for her novel, Mad Atom. Margaret Atwood's most recent books are the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, The Testaments, in 2019, a poetry collection, Dearly, in 2020, and Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts, in 2023. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.